Hey y'all, it's Lauren. St. Louis is consistently listed as one of the worst asthma capitals in the country by the Asthma and Allergy Foundation of America. And during the pandemic, environmental issues such as dust from demolitions and housing conditions make it even harder for people to breathe. At a time when children are already experiencing learning loss because of educational disparities and access to technology, asthma can also disrupt a child's academic performance and behavior in school even more. That's why I wanted to start this episode on a more personal note by introducing you to my mom, Michelle Brown, an educator across the water in Illinois who has asthma and understands the role educators take on to ensure the health and safety of their students.
It was about, I would say, 7 years ago. And I had like a really bad cold that wouldn't go away. And then it turned into a really bad cough. And so I kept saying, oh, just a cold, just a flu or something. I said, I should be fine. But it was lasting like for weeks and weeks and weeks. So my husband would say, I think you may need to go to the doctor just to double check. So I went to the doctor. And so when he heard my cough and how I was breathing, I immediately went to the hospital in front of the doctor's office. When I got there, they said that my breathing was really, really low and that it was almost at a dangerous point.
She did not realize that you could be diagnosed with asthma at any age and any point in your lifespan, which made it difficult for her to learn her asthma triggers right away.
So with me, I noticed if it's really cold outside and it's really windy, that's when my asthma really started acting up. So that's when I really have to make sure I use my albuterol inhaler before I go outside. But I usually don't take it on a regular basis. Like most people take it on that regular basis. I don't do that. I just usually use it when I can feel it coming on. When I feel the tightness in my chest, then I'll do it. But I remember the first time I didn't use it and I went outside and it was windy outside and it took all I had to get my breath. So I immediately had to go back in the house. I said, oh, this feels kind of weird. I said, my chest was tight. And I said, so I took the albuterol and then after that, it opened up my chest so I was able to breathe better. So then going forward, whenever it got windy or cold, I made sure I took my inhaler before I went outside into those type of weather. It's even when it's hot too, like if it's really hot outside, the same effect happens.
Even though her initial reaction to her breathing problems was to brush it off, she remembered how her motherly instincts went into action when her two daughters experienced problems as infants.
So I immediately took them to the doctor. And at one point, my youngest daughter, she was in the hospital because of her breathing was so bad. And she stayed in there for at least, I want to say a month. And what I found very different was that I noticed they use this technique where they like hit on her back up and down so they can kind of break up the cold in her back. And I was like, oh my God, why are they beating her on her chest like that and on her back? But they had to loosen it up so they can eventually, you know, come out. But it was really traumatizing for me to see that.
The youngest daughter she is talking about is me. And I remember during my preschool and school age years, I had to sit for breathing treatments twice a day, oxygen mask and all. One of my asthma triggers was hot and dry air, which would lead to wheezing. I eventually grew out of it, but still experienced trouble breathing from time to time in older age. But my mom believes the history of people of color's resistance to care was the reason why she didn't take action sooner in her personal life, like she did for me and my sister.
When I was growing up, I noticed that my parents, like when we were sick, my mother always had some remedy to fix something. So I think that's one of the reasons why I didn't go, because I was sort of like, oh, you know, I'll just take this. My mother said, well, take that. You're fine. You know, just go take a nap, you know, things like that. So I think that the way I was brought up is the reason why I waited so long to go to the doctor too, because my mom would tell me, oh, you're fine. Just, you know, you just need to take a nap or just take some Tylenol, like things like that. So that played a lot of me not going too.
Black people and people of color have experienced racial discrimination in the healthcare system for decades. And a 2005 report from the National Academy of Medicine found that racial and ethnic minorities receive lower quality healthcare than white people, even when insurance status, income, age, and severity of conditions are comparable.
Everybody that goes into the hospital should be treated the same way, no matter where you came from, what kind of medical insurance you have. It should be the same across the board, but I don't think we get the same services as other people. And that's a problem. So I'm hoping that things change with the new government so that, you know, people are treated the way they should be treated. Because a lot of people of color are just dying because of they don't have the necessities that they need to have in order to survive and live like everyone else. And that's really, that's just really a sad situation where a lot of, I think a lot of people of color, sometimes they don't even go to the hospital because they know how they're going to be treated and they try to medicate themselves at home. And that's another thing that's really, really sad to me, that you don't feel safe enough to go to the hospital where you're supposed to get the care that you need. So you try to medicate yourself at home because of that reason, because you know you're not going to be treated fairly when you go anyway. And that's just really a disservice.
And as an educator, Michelle sees how inequities in healthcare affect children in her classroom, especially when asthma is such a common condition in preschool-age children.
What I've noticed, because we have to do the all the kids' physicals when they first start in the program, and just about, I will have to say, at least 6 or 7 kids per classroom has asthma. And that's a lot of children, because it's about 20 students per class, and we have 8 classrooms. So if you have like 6 or 7 kids per classroom, that's a lot of kids with asthma already at this young age. So yeah, it's pretty scary. And they're like 3, 4, and 5-year-olds.
She also points out how cognizant teachers have to be of each student's medical list. At her school, the list is posted in the classroom so that they would know immediately to send them to the nurse's office when signs of struggle arise. And she recalls a time when all of the factors, including access to care, educator awareness, and parental guidance, came into play.
We had this one little boy that he had asthma really, really bad. He had to be on an inhaler like in the morning when he gets to school, he had to do it again at lunchtime, then he had to do it again before he went home. And it got so bad that his mom couldn't afford for him to have his inhaler. So the nurses were trying to find another program for him to get, you know, to get a cheaper cost for them to be able to afford it. And she was struggling trying to get medication for him. And it got to the point where she couldn't get medication for him. So he was at school one day and he had an asthma attack. And of course the nurse, you know, called the parents and then they called the paramedics to pick him up. So they took him to the hospital. But it was so bad that his attack was so bad that he was almost not even breathing by the time he got to the hospital. And if he would have had better services as far as getting his medication, I think he would have been able to, the family would have been able to handle his situation better. But he ended up passing away because it was so severe and it wasn't managed. So the parents, you know, wasn't able to get the right medication that he needed. So he passed away and he was only 5. So that was very, very scary, very, very a sad situation. That to me, if a person has asthma, it should be some kind of services that if you can't afford it, you should be able to still get the medication that you need in order to have a, you know, productive life and be able to, you know, breathe.
And that same sense of urgency and awareness became apparent in her life when the COVID-19 pandemic hit. As a member of the management staff, she had to work on site with the worries of catching the virus waving over her head.
When it first started, I noticed that it was like a lot of people testing positive from the district office because the preschool building is connected to the district office. So everyone in the district office was getting like positive results from it. And then, so that made me scared because I'm like, I don't want them to come out down this way because I have, a lot of health issues that I'm afraid that I might get it. And I'm really afraid to get that because what if I do get it and I can't breathe? And I'm already having issues already. Are they going to be able to help me to the full extent, or would it be a danger zone for me?
Understanding all of the factors that can contribute to her and others' asthma is the reason why she says the pandemic has only increased the issues we already see. But the main thing she is hoping for is a more racially equitable healthcare system for the next generation.
I just want them to really reevaluate the healthcare system for everyone so that it's fair for everyone. If a person is sick and needs to go to the hospital, they should be able to go to any hospital they want to go to. And they should be able to get the services that every patient gets. And they should feel safe enough to say, hey, if I go to the hospital, they're going to help me feel better. Not, I'm going to go to the hospital and I'm going to die at the hospital because I'm not going to get the services that I deserve. I think going forward that people, governments should really reevaluate this whole medical system and to make it fair across the board. And it shouldn't be where you work at, it shouldn't be where you live at. It should just be anyone should have the same medical coverage.
The quality of life for Black and brown people is significantly lower than for their white counterparts. And the disparities we see in asthma clearly show the environmental challenges that affect the most vulnerable communities in St. Louis. So in this episode, we hear from a chronic disease epidemiologist and health education coordinator about an initiative to create healthier homes. An educator who collects racial and ethnic data to help us understand environmental issues in our region, and a reverend putting matters into his own hands to help his community live in a healthier environment. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. For years, St. Louis has been one of the top 10 most segregated cities in the country. Its legacy of systemic and structural racism has a direct effect on the environmental issues faced by poor Black and brown communities. The Washington University Interdisciplinary Environmental Law Clinic's Environmental Racism in St. Louis report, which we covered in our last episode, points out that Black children in St. Louis are 10 times more likely to visit an emergency room for asthma than white children. That's why St. Louis City's equity score for asthma is the lowest possible score of 1 on a scale of 100, where 100 indicates racial equity, no differences in outcomes between Black and white people. To help us understand how St. Louis County, which is around 68% white and 25% Black, compares to St. Louis City, we spoke to Dr. Niall Tootlam, chronic disease epidemiologist for the St. Louis County Department of Public Health. And he says, even within St. Louis County, there are clear disparities between predominantly Black North St. Louis County and the more affluent West and South counties.
So what sorts of conditions we people live in and work in and play in and things like that, right? We do know that the northern part of the county is a more economically deprived area. So if you look at the rate of uninsured tends to be also higher in those regions of the county. And so we think that access is part of the problem. And so we see higher rates, for example, of emergency department visits in those particular zip codes, meaning that the asthma is less controlled in those parts of the county.
According to the St. Louis County Department of Public Health, the most inner and outer areas of North St. Louis County had the highest rates of emergency department discharges for asthma from 2013 to 2017. To address this, Dr. Tootlam says that we need to understand how environmental factors affect asthma rates.
So if people who live in lower income areas, maybe you live closer to a landfill or you live closer to a place where there are all these industrial areas where, you know, there are asthma triggers, that can be an environmental racism justice issue. We can focus on that and look at what is it that we can do to sort of mitigate some of those things. And that's where I think programs like ours, the Healthy Homes, they come in.
Lauren Pyatt is a health education coordinator for the Healthy Homes program.
Our focus is home health and safety, childhood diseases like asthma. We do a lot of work around lead poisoning prevention. But when it comes to asthma, right now, phone assessments, working on virtual assessments, and pre-COVID, we're doing in-home assessments to help identify asthma triggers, try and connect folks to partners and resources to help identify those asthma triggers, and kind of offering recommendations, resources, referrals for next steps to help identify those. And so what that means is we're going into homes. We have some specialized equipment that helps us identify asthma triggers, moisture level, all things that we know can help or hurt your asthma management in the home.
In order to understand what needs to change in a person's living environment, they need to know the most common asthma triggers.
Dust mites, cockroaches, pet dander, rodents, secondhand smoke, mold, all of those are prevalent environmental asthma triggers. Some folks know what their triggers are. Not everyone does. Some folks who have asthma know what they're allergic to. Other times you might need to go and see an allergist to really identify really what those asthma triggers are. But we use some specialized equipment to test for indoor air quality, what moisture levels are. We know when there's a lot of moisture in the air, that's an environment that's really conducive for mold growth or for dust mites, and then offer some a range of recommendations of what can be done. Some of those are talking about changing your air filters and the regularity of that, how you do that, because not all of them are changed the same way. It can be talking about running a dehumidifier or a humidifier, washing your pillows and your stuffed animals in hot water so you're killing any dust mites, making referrals so that you can get mattress and pillow encasements, cleaning parts of your refrigerator that you don't think about cleaning that can be harboring moisture, mold, pests.
The Healthy Homes Program is now working through Medicaid to reach even more people in the region.
If there's a doctor's referral to our program, we can come out and do our full home assessment. And then the health department also gets reimbursed for that, which helps us also be able to have more funds to offer more supplies that we can use for asthma kits to kind of help families address some of the identified hazards and environmental asthma triggers in the home. So right now we're just doing phone assessments for COVID. We're working on how that can be virtual and when it's safe to do that again. We plan to resume those in-home site visits.
Just under 200 homes went through the Healthy Homes Assessment, and 147 asthma home consultations were conducted from 2014 to 2018. And Dr. Tootlam believes collaboration is a step in the right direction.
We work with partners a lot because as the health department, we also feel like our role, we serve as conveners so we can bring people, different groups of people together, you know, as a government agency. And we also have the data to show people at the very granular levels. Our data usually goes up to the zip code level. We can say, for example, zip code 63134, where we are, the rate is this much, is higher. We try to work with different partners so that at least when we do find something, then if it's something that we aren't able to do as the health department, then other partners can step in.
Dr. Tootlam says that he comes at it from a personal point of view, which pushes him to address the health challenges he sees head on.
From a personal point of view, I have a six-year-old daughter who was asthmatic. And so when I look at the data, I have her in the back of my mind. And so when Lauren talks about some of these triggers, I think about those even in my own home and say, okay, what are the things that we can control? And unfortunately, we are in that group of people who are with the knowledge, who also have probably a little bit more resources than, say, compared to some people. And we're fortunate in that sense. I have all access to this information that the health department produces, and I'm able to try to use that information even within my own personal life and try to address those. But even beyond that, even working within the department itself, so when I or my team, when we produce the data and we see, okay, for this year that we see 6,000 kids who have gone to the emergency department visits, and the rates are much higher in 63134 or 63136 or all those zip codes in North County, right? And I take them to Lauren and the team and show them, hey, this is what we see. We see the rates are much higher in this. And they say, huh, this is something we can actually use and say, maybe when next time we go out for visits, we can, you know, deliberately target some of these zip codes and direct resources that way.
And for Lauren, the families she works with in the Healthy Homes Program continue to show strength and resilience, even in the face of adversity.
It's always inspiring when we're doing these site visits, how much parents are dedicating everything they can to follow everything that their doctor outlines for their asthma management plan. When they're doing all of the right things and the steps to take, and it's kind of outside of their control based on the housing conditions, whether that's out of state landlords who aren't addressing those issues or municipalities who have confusing residential code enforcement codes. And I think that's an ongoing challenge that we have because we are doing those in-home site visits and can see those, but our scope is limited. We can make those referrals, but we don't have any kind of stick that we can use to see that those get addressed. We can write up as many recommendations and make referrals to all of the right people who should, but that's still kind of parts of this that slip through the cracks. especially uniquely to St. Louis County, because we have so many different municipalities. Some of those contract out with the county, some of them do their own in-home, in-municipality code enforcement, and they're all different, and they have different levels of what is acceptable, and to know how to navigate that. And that is just an ongoing struggle with this kind of work. And I think that there is a lot that needs to be done in that realm, but that's kind of beyond what we have the ability to do with the Healthy Homes Program.
Dr. Tulum and Lauren addressed how St. Louis County is trying to eliminate racial disparities within asthma rates for their residents, especially children. So we wanted to learn more about the effects asthma has on school-aged children and their overall academic performance, which is why we spoke to Kelly Harris, an instructor of occupational therapy and surgery in the Public Health Sciences Division at Washington University School of Medicine, and author of Mapping Inequality, Childhood Asthma and Environmental Injustice, a case study of St. Louis, Missouri, about the impact asthma has on education.
I think it's important to kind of have more consistent and kind of clear education around asthma awareness, like knowledge of symptoms. I think it's all about your proximity, right? So if you're working with students with asthma on a regular basis, understanding the triggers, being able to identify symptoms, being able to support them, especially younger students, is really important. Helping students to self-manage. I have two children with asthma as well, and that's something that has been very important to us, is helping them to identify and know how to avoid asthma triggers, how to identify their own symptoms early. So I think that's important in terms of the education piece and understanding kind of what guidelines are, what should we be doing for students with asthma, what are best practices, understanding those.
Helping children understand how to manage their asthma is just one challenge.
Asthma is the number one reason kids miss school. And so school absence is probably the primary factor. I think when I talk to teachers and other school providers, that's one of the things I hear first, is absence is an issue. Missed time in the classroom, in the seat, or lost learning opportunities. And so I think that's a challenge. I think that there are other challenges related to having asthma exacerbations, right? If you can't breathe, you're not gonna be able to do, you know, homework or whatever other related schoolwork you might have. It's harder to kind of engage with the material. It's harder to be present in the moment if you're struggling to breathe. I mean, that's a basic kind of, when we think about our hierarchy of needs, right? There are medications that have some side effects. I think if kids are waking up at night, not getting well rested because of asthma symptoms, and they're coming to school and they're tired, kind of that attention and motivation is impacted. There's kind of a myriad of effects in that regard. So absence is kind of the big factor. That's probably the one that we can most change. There's also a body of research that really looks at students' ability to kind of connect to the school environment, school connectedness, and thinking about teacher trust, peer trust. And if you're missing a lot of school or experiencing asthma-related symptoms frequently, your motivation to engage with those things, extracurriculars, and to have that kind of close bond with your teachers and peers can be strained and create a challenge as well.
The disparities in asthma rates between Black and white children clearly show why asthma is a racial justice issue and how the environments we live in have a direct impact on our well-being.
Structural racism and what I talked about in that piece is environmental injustice. Those are factors that have kind of been created in our neighborhoods and in our environments that are underlying the disparities that we see in asthma prevalence, in asthma exacerbations, and in our access to healthcare to address those concerns. And so I think it's clearly a racial justice issue when we have this kind of spatial disparity in terms of where high prevalence rates are and where care is located, when we have environments that are ripe with triggers for asthma, right?
Kelly emphasizes that there isn't just one environmental issue impacting asthma and other chronic respiratory conditions.
Thinking about equity and housing condition is definitely important, right? But just thinking about our neighborhoods, air quality, access to green space, reducing pollution. So really monitoring and enforcing regulations around air pollution, thinking about our school environments. So it's not just home environments, because kids spend a great deal of time in schools, right? And so if you're in old buildings that also are full of asthma triggers, that's equally challenging for youth with asthma. So, you know, in terms of large scale structural change, I think those are some of the things we could think about, right? And I think adding resources. So thinking about how we help support youth with asthma in schools, while that's not preventative in nature, I think it's still important. And I think that these things go hand in hand. We have to really understand the problem and understand the impact in order to really get at the root kind of causes and addressing those and solutions.
Kelly believes providing more support for children in schools and in the home can help mitigate the asthma prevalence we see in low-income Black communities. So we asked her, what type of environment is she hoping to create for the next generation?
Thinking about healthy environments in multifaceted healthy environments, right? So physically healthy, environmentally healthy, emotionally healthy, thinking about environments in all of those ways, right? With COVID and people spending less time in their cars and more time at home, is that air pollution in a lot of cities where it's a big challenge has gone down. And so I think that's something worth looking at in St. Louis. And so if that is, you know, if that's a positive kind of side effect of this really challenging year that we've had, thinking about what we can do to create that kind of healthier space in a long-term way, right? It's not realistic to ask people to not drive, but what kind of environmental solutions can we put in place to really think about just healthier air, safer spaces, more green space, more outdoor opportunities for our kids?
We know the issues the most vulnerable communities in St. Louis are facing and what some of the programs and ideas behind tackling them are. As researchers, educators, and service providers are tackling asthma through data and programs, there are also everyday people who are working to create a better environment for their families, friends, and loved ones. So up next, we hear from a local pastor about his congregation's struggles with asthma and how he has become a leader in environmental change for the St. Louis region. The Environmental Racism in St. Louis report features stories from everyday people facing environmental challenges. And Reverend Roderick Burton, the senior pastor of New Northside Missionary Baptist Church, was one of them. He says the problems he sees daily are why he wanted to get involved with the Washington University Environmental Law Clinic's report.
Many of the issues that are environmental justice issues at times, because of all the multitude of other issues facing African Americans, you know, racism, police brutality, economic issues, you name it. Oftentimes, the environmental justice piece gets left to, you know, stereotypically, you know, white middle class people, upper middle class. And so we are directly impacted. And so, you know, I, God only knows. It's just falling upon me to start lifting that up in our area. And I think it's important to help connect the dots so that many people understand they've been dealing with environmental justice. They just hadn't had a lingo for it. It hadn't been translated that way. So that's why it's been important to me.
Reverend Burton first learned how to manage asthma by caring for his wife and two children who have the condition.
And so I learned about asthma from, you know, running and making sure that we had emergency inhalers. And then once I became a pastor, you know, there's a large swath of our members who have asthma. You know, you go on field trips with the youth, you got to make sure they have an inhaler. Our praise dancers, one of the young praise dancers had an asthma attack after dancing.
And Reverend Burton says asthma is one example of how environmental issues and racial justice issues go hand in hand.
We just asked members of our congregation raise their hand or lift their inhaler, and 2/3 of the congregation had their hands raised and they had their inhalers raised.
Because asthma is so common in his congregation, Reverend Burton began keeping Primatene Mist emergency inhalers on hand just in case. They would quickly relieve asthma symptoms such as wheezing, coughing, shortness of breath, and chest tightening. But the original Primatene Mist was discontinued in 2011 by the FDA because of its ozone-depleting propellant.
And so we were struggling when all of a sudden those weren't available. It was a stress on us. And so then I had to work a second, actually, I took a third job to have enough money to, you know, to pay for the copay to have emergency inhalers, because it was not an option. If an asthmatic does not have an inhaler and they have an asthma attack, they die. I mean, it's not an option. It's not, well, you know, they can get by.
7 years later, Primatene Mist came back with a new formula by a different company. The new version uses a safer propellant and is now the only FDA-approved over-the-counter inhaler. Conversations about asthma paved the way for conversations about the connection between the environment and health disparities.
And so by informing the congregation, helping them to understand that it's just not by chance that we have so many people that have asthma, about the disparities, and then also making sure whenever there's opportunities to advocate from the healthcare community, you know, say, hey, you need to do this. You need to work better in these areas because of the outcomes on the African-American community, on our church, on our community.
But asthma isn't the only environmental problem affecting his community. There's a host of other factors, such as vacancies, illegal dumping, food apartheid, and more, affecting the quality of life for Black people.
When you have an area, there's no investment, okay? And so as long as it's allowed to be an area where there is illegal dumping, okay, where there is the businesses leave and they leave in an environmental mini disaster, there's not going to be any investment, okay? You're continuing to make self-fulfilling prophecy by allowing those conditions to exist. So by cleaning areas up and keeping an area well, then there's the ability for companies to put in investment and change the community. And also, you know, you just look at the despair. They had an article about Wellston. And so the kids were riding a bus every day and they're driving past this area. Just been dumping continually. And the mayor was saying, that's just an example of how that just says to those kids and nobody cares about this area. And if you see that and you grow up seeing that, boy, people really don't care about this area where I live, that's demoralized. You know what I mean? It's demotivating. People say, well, I need to move somewhere else. But guess what? Everyone cannot move everywhere. We should have the capacity and the power to clean up where people live. Somebody has to get up every morning and they see vacant houses. And then because there's vacant houses, other people feel the liberty to come and dump and cause even more of a disaster in that area, that impacts those who have to live there, okay? And then that's not fair in any way. And that has to be addressed so that people in impoverished areas should not have to live that way. And they don't have the funds, they don't have people advocating for them. And so that's why it's very important that movements such as Green to Church, we gotta connect those dots. We gotta help people to see these things so that they too will become allies and they will lift things up.
Reverend Burton's congregation has partnered with Green the Church, a sustainability initiative designed to tap into the power and purpose of the Black church community and expand the role of churches as centers for environmental and economic resilience. And they were the first African-American congregation to install solar panels on their church and community center, showing the region an environmentally friendly path forward.
One of the things that I wanted to do was I wanted for an African-American congregation to take the lead in showing how renewables can be practical and can be useful. And so at the time, it was more of a pragmatic thought. As you know, as I learned more, then it was like, OK, this is the reason why we need to do this. But at the time, it's pragmatic. But now it's even more so much important that for someone else who may be wondering, what can I do? What effect can be made for them to be able to drive by and see the solar panels? They can say, okay, you know, that's an African-American church. If they did it, we can do it. And so every year we save $3,000 with our solar panel. And that's money that's used for ministry, you know, as opposed to paying the electric bill.
Reverend Burton is also leading the way as a member of St. Louis City's Clean Energy Advisory Board, which seeks to educate the public about the importance of clean energy and acquire input from city residents about the future plan. The plan comes from Resolution 124, which was passed in 2017 and caused the city to develop a plan to transition to 100% clean energy in the form of wind, solar, and energy efficiency measures by 2035. And Reverend Burton hopes the city will continue to engage with and receive input from community residents, because it's the only way the Resolution 124 plan and other environmental plans will be inclusive.
The Green New Deal can be just as racist and exclusive as the old energy order. You know, people have to make it as it is brought in. You have to make sure the integration, the equity is there, you know, and that happens through people's advocacy, because there's nothing to say that, you know, great, we have all this great renewable energy and there's still communities excluded. There's still, you know, racism, sexism, you know, homophobia, and we don't want to do that. And so what we want to do is you got to advocate as it's being built. So right now that type of economy is in the planning stages. There's got to be advocacy and reaching in to have other voices as it's planned out, as it's developed, so that it develops in a way that's, you know, not only good for the environment, but good for the people who live in the environment.
With all of the work Reverend Burton and other community leaders are doing to support environmental justice, we wanted to know, what's at stake if we don't cater to the communities who need it the most?
You know, I'm a pastor, and I'm going to look at things through a faith view. I'm going to look at things through a view of concern for people out of that's my belief. But not everyone, the people who have the power and have the money, they don't necessarily look at it that way. And so what you have to do is you have to frame things in an economic expense. Look, by you allowing these disparities to continue to happen, basically it's costing you money, because at some point you're going to have to, just like by not addressing climate change, you know, you're spending more money on responses to hurricanes and disasters. By allowing these disparities to exist, it's still money that's coming out of your pocket. You're just not seeing it. You know what I mean? By empowering communities that are disempowered, lifting people up so they too can participate and have economics to make the country better, to put more money in the tax structure, that's good for everybody. So sometimes you got to frame that way, because the reality is a lot of folks in our state, you know, you come with the altruistic arguments, the philosophical arguments, they are not wanting to hear that. You just stop at the door. And so you have to frame things economically. Hey, guess what? These sustainability things, they save money. They save your company money. They'll save our community money.
Addressing issues head on and educating the next generation on what environmental justice looks like can be a challenge. But Reverend Burton says the ability to engage with nature gives him a sense of solace and the ability to go on.
Every once in a while, when, you know, being a pastor gets too overwhelming, I will go to, there's a park conservation area where the Mississippi and the Missouri River come together. It's the confluence. And so when you go there, you know, you can so appreciate the power and the majesty of the creation. And it's peaceful. And what's amazing is to see these two massive bodies of water, all that water coming together. And you know what? There's no struggle. It's just coming together, you know. And then to see all that water and think about, boy, water and air, you don't get any more fundamental than that. Okay. And so if the air is bad and if the water is bad, it doesn't matter what your socioeconomic status, it doesn't matter where you came from. You will not live. And so everyone should be able to have clean air and clean water. Everyone should be able to go to somewhere that's set aside and beautiful, and to be able to enjoy nature, to commune with nature, to be recharged by nature. And so that's why it's important to me that this fight continues to keep our resources that are there for humanity to be well kept.
This show is produced by me, Lauren Brown, and lead producer Jolianne Yang. You can request a phone assessment of housing-related health and safety hazards from the St. Louis County Department of Public Health Healthy Homes Program by calling 314-615-6255. 5323. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. From PRX.